the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. Me and Jason have with us today, sitting in the studio, the number one, the illustrious, the magnificent, the bald pathologist. And he's going to tell us all about some soybean diseases, but we also got another guest for you.
Herbie on line one. Herbie on line one.
Hey, Trent, what you got going on? I know you're somewhere east of Memphis and west of Starkville, and I don't hear any bumps.
East of Memphis?
I just pulled over on the side of the road to make this easier.
You meant south of Memphis, right?
East and south. Okay. Doesn't matter, really. If he's east of Memphis and west of Starkville, that means he's somewhere in the middle of Mississippi, probably.
Yeah, Dr. McCoy had a small plot tour this morning at Verona, so we went up to visit with a few guys there this morning.
We're going to have to get McCoy on the podcast.
He's too entrepreneurial to come on. He might charge us money.
That's possible. Thompson, they're not saying we can only guess that Tom's here because it rained 7 inches the other day.
Yeah. Fact.
You're breathing hard, Tom.
Did it rain all that rust off the corn?
No, it did not. Blew the rust up even more in places where it's rained.
So now you're going to be even more of an orange man.
That's the photo from halfway through the evaluations that day. That's not the last plot photo. I did take that photo. I didn't share that photo.
but once you're orange, dude.
I know.
I mean, you don't get oranger.
No, you cannot get more orange than that.
I mean,
that.
You're pretty much like a big fat Cheeto right there.
Correct. And you just continue to either wash it off of you or find places you missed.
For those guys that don't know what we're talking about, just check out at Bald Pathologist on the Twitter and see his lovely photos of his glowing orange dust bowl that was all over him. I think it turned to mud by the time you were done.
I'd buy that.
You look pretty nasty. Did one bottle of Dial do that, or did you have to get the Puma soap out to get it off?
I don't even remember what I used. One of those charcoal bars to scrub the bald head.
Sound check on Irby.
I'm just sitting here laughing.
I was going to say, he's probably grinning.
All right, so we didn't come in here to talk about corn.
No, I don't think we did.
No, we did not.
So, Tom, what's the status of our disease situation in soybean?
You know, that's definitely what we're here to talk about.
Well, hold on before we do that.
I'm sorry.
And I'm not trying to
interrupt.
I didn't mean to
take over the show.
No, you didn't take over the show. Trent, how about you give us an idea of the growth stages across the different corners of the state, and then Tom can direct his questions into where they are pertinent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds fine. So, I mean, just like it always is in beans, the growth stages are kind of scattered around the board. If you had to look at the majority average, you know, we're in the mid R5 range to approaching R6.5. We have some acres that are further than that, a few acres that are going to be younger than that, obviously, and depending on where you're standing and the situations that went on. But the overall average, I'd say, would fall in that kind of early R5, R5.5 to approaching R6.5.
Do you feel like it's pretty consistent, Trent? I mean, assuming a similar planting date, you know, that the big bulk of the crop that got planted, you know, when the weather broke last spring, do you feel like that kind of range in there over a 2-week period, it feels like it's pretty consistent to me. But I'm not looking at growth stages. I'm just looking at, you know, windshield in it.
Yeah, it does feel consistent. I mean, there's a few places that feel like they got delayed for whatever reason, that based on plant date and where they actually are, they're not quite as far along as they should be, but that's not uncommon in our state, especially with the environmental conditions that we experience shortly after planting. You know, I guess every year we'll have beans that kind of sit there when it's cool and wet and don't really grow off quite as normal. But this year, I'd say we're probably more consistent than normal, especially, you know, with that bulk of the land they got planted in the first big planting window. Give us a disease update, Tom.
Okay. I would say, following Trent's comments regarding the growth stages, up until like the last 10 days ago, quiet. you know, a little bit of septoria brown spot, a little bit of target spot in a lower canopy. Very few reports of frog eye leaf spot this year. I think I've seen a handful of lesions, but have had a few consultants contact me with some better photos that certainly I would have been able to take. But I would say about the middle of last week, I had somebody from East Mississippi call, send me some pictures, and I ended up running to Newton to look at what that was. And we have several fields of soybean rust in the greater metropolitan Newton, Mississippi area.
What does metropolitan Newton look like?
Not a lot of fields in town. The fields are definitely out of town, but I'd say Newton, Mississippi and Newton County. Newton, Mississippi is within Newton County, geographically speaking. The bulk of the fields in that county are close or adjacent to the town of Newton. Would be generally south and west and south and east of downtown Newton.
So the fields that are affected, what growth stage are they at?
The fields that are affected are about like what Trent just said, all over the board when it comes to growth stage. The bulk of those fields are R6, and I would say out of the woods at R6, and out of a stage where you would consider a management option that might reduce any issues associated with soybean rust.
So don't spray the soybean rust is what I hear you saying.
In those R6 fields, don't spray the soybean rust. The problem is, like most parts of the state, they were delayed in some of those plantings, and there are some fields in that general area that are R5.5 and a little earlier than R5.5. In those field situations, we suggested making a fungicide application simply because you got a ways to go on those beans. You're talking about 2+ weeks until you hit R6. And with the cooler temperatures and the amount of rainfall we received in that area over the last 7 to 10 days, that's definitely going to do nothing but heat up the amount of soybean rust that's in some of those fields. Now, the hard part about that, and I should say, I don't generally get a lot of telephone calls about soybean rust, and rarely do I get pictures from folks that look like soybean rust. Most of the pictures I get are somebody says, hey, you know, I got soybean rust. I'm like, that's not soybean rust.
Is that because it's not 1998 anymore?
Well, part of that is, A, we don't talk about it much. B, we don't necessarily have a concern associated with that particular disease. And C, I think a lot of people misdiagnose soybean rust for something else. And in this situation, the field representative really thought he was looking at septoria brown spot for the better part of a month. And when he called, he said, man, it just keeps getting worse, and the fields just don't look right. And I said, well, send me some pictures. I said, but show me the underside of the leaf. And that's the biggest issue. When you're looking at brown spot, you're looking through the canopy, and you're looking at the top of the leaf. Soybean rust has to be diagnosed from the bottom of the leaf. The underside of the leaf, is that adaxial surface for those scientific folks?
I like the bottom of the leaf.
I like the bottom of the leaf.
Much more descriptive.
It's much more descriptive in my opinion. Top of the leaf, underside of the leaf, bottom of the leaf. You've got to look for the actual pustules. And what I tell folks, buy a 20X hand lens. It's one of the best investments you'll ever make if you're checking fields for plant diseases. You can see everything you need to see pretty much that I talk about on the blog, on anything I talk about on this podcast, and anything that I put on Twitter. You can see the bulk of that with a 20X hand lens. And you can tell the difference between septoria brown spot and soybean rust pretty easily with a hand lens.
What could I confuse? You're talking about confusing soybean rust with other things. What else could I confuse it with?
You could confuse it with bacterial blight, bacterial pustules, septoria brown spot. Target spot if it wasn't necessarily developing the right appearance. But soybean rust produces such beautiful little volcanoes on the underside of the leaf. If you're seeing those through a hand lens, you really know that's what you're looking at. And the other thing is it can be a massive defoliator of the lower canopy. And in the fields we looked at on Friday, you could part the canopy and hit the bean plants together, and it was just a cloud of spores coming out of those soybean plants. You know, but that's one of those ones. The last couple of weeks, I've had a few questions about it, and it's not one we've talked about much because it hasn't been near as large a yield reducer as what was predicted to occur circa 2004.
All right. In addition to rust, what else are we looking at out there in the landscape?
It's a lot of root diseases, and that's pretty typical this time of the year. And especially this year, because I don't think we've had weather patterns that have been real conducive for most of the foliar diseases. A lot of taproot decline out there. I still get a lot of telephone calls about taproot decline.
How yield limiting is taproot decline? I hear y'all talk about it all the time, and then being a late season disease.
Well, that depends on the situation, because the hard part is, Bobby, you can find it really early in a season. And in some of those field situations where we've had continuous soybean production for a long period of time and a tremendous amount of reduced tillage in some of those field situations, we did some little small plot type testing probably 5-6 years ago and really felt that it could be as severe as 30% reduction in yield.
If it starts early.
If it starts early and kills plants, you could have a 30% reduction in yield.
So what's early, prior to bloom or early vegetative? I mean,
the infection from that fungus can occur shortly after emergence from cotyledon stages.
So by early, you mean early, early.
You can find that disease if you know what you're looking for, and that's the hard part about V2, V3. But it's a hands and knees, and it's pretty subtle to tell what that actually looks like on leaf tissue. You get into where we're at right now, R5.5, R6, and it's easy to see it because it's an upper canopy foliage issue. And then usually if you part the canopy back and you see any of that interveinal chlorosis from taproot decline, you'll find some dead plants around there. But I've not seen...
I mentioned some of the other things that the foliar symptoms could be mistaken for, and kind of how to determine that it's probably taproot decline and not one of those other issues.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, Trent. The hard thing is there are a pile of things that'll produce interveinal chlorosis. Taproot decline tends to be fairly characteristic. Usually what I tell folks is if you find plants in a field that are just a few scattered plants, one plant here or a clump of two or three plants, if they're producing sort of green veins with yellow coloration in between the veins, what is more commonly referred to as interveinal chlorosis, grab those plants and jerk them out of the ground. If you jerk them out of the ground and the taproot breaks off below the soil profile, and you actually can look at what's left of the root and it looks like it's dry rotted, so it broke really easily, or you have any black discoloration on the roots itself, that's taproot decline.
How hard do you got to jerk?
Hard enough to just remove the plant. Usually if you're trying to remove the plant from soil profile and it's got taproot decline, you'll break it off anyways.
So do you
got
to jerk or do you pull?
I mean, say jerk. Jerk it out roughly. See what it does.
So don't be easy with it.
No, don't be gentle at all.
So those plants down there in South Washington County that we had to walk back to my truck and get the shovel for, obviously not taproot decline.
Yeah,
that is correct.
They'll come out of the ground really easily.
Especially after Bobby jumped up and down on the shovel to get it to go in the ground.
Well, and like Trent said, you know, there's a pile of other things that could be confused with that. Sudden death syndrome, which is one that's definitely much more of a Midwestern issue, although you get up into parts of Tennessee and they do have a bit more sudden death syndrome. We typically have sudden death syndrome in field situations that have a soybean cyst nematode component. And those are ones, I mean, folks need to send samples off and actually determine they have a soybean cyst nematode issue. It's usually a football-sized area in a field that'll be a sudden death syndrome situation with a soybean cyst nematode component. Stem canker can be confused for taproot decline, but, you know, you pretty much can trace that back as to whether or not you have a stem canker susceptible variety. And I'm trying to think of some other things. Red crown rot's another one of those. But that's pretty rare. That's more of an East Mississippi and East Central Mississippi issue.
So, Tom, while you're thinking of more diseases, Trent, what's your feeling of what listed? What's the number one call you get on soybean disease, or what you feel like is the most economically pertinent disease to be scouting for and managing soybean?
Well, I guess, and Tom, I think, can chime in on this too, but I think it would be year dependent. This year, and like Tom mentioned a minute ago, most calls that I'm getting right now are root-related problems. Not all of it is disease. You know, some of it's just compaction issues. But I think most of the issues that we're dealing with right now are a direct result of all of the rain we've had for two years now. You know, the lack of field work we've been able to do in some places, and then not being able to rotate to other crops and get out of soybeans and get into something else. It's a lot of wet feed issues kind of thing. Foliar disease-wise, up until just a few days ago, I've gotten very few phone calls on anything like that. We've had a little bit of area web blight, I guess. I've heard some guys do some treatments for web blight in a couple of places, but nothing tremendously widespread.
Places that we have considered could be more problematic, but we don't typically run across area web blight like the greater part of the Delta. But it tended to be a little triangular area. It was more or less between Webb, Tutwiler, and Charleston, and that general vicinity over there was more of our area web blight concern in the Delta. It's definitely more of a south of I-20 issue than anything most years. Although, you know, I did get a bunch of people call and say, you know, hey, we didn't put out an automatic R3, R4. Could we tie that right back to aerial web blight? And I said, no, not necessarily. I think it's just it's indicative of the environment that we received within that little general area. I don't think you can tie that directly back to the fact that maybe you did or did not put out an automatic fungicide application.
Well, you know, we were in a field the other day, got called to it, and I had Jeffrey with me, and you trained him so well. He said, you know, I think this is aerial web blight, and it was up in the day where he couldn't see it, but he said it smells like cat pee out here.
Yeah, and that's
what's with that? I mean, I don't.
That's what I tell folks, that if you really want a good diagnostic expression of what that disease can do, grab some plants that are affected, stuff them in a Ziploc bag, or heck, stick them in a paper bag and throw them on the back seat and forget about them and come back a day later. And when you get in the truck and it smells like cat pee, you're probably going to be dealing with area web blight. For whatever reason, those plants just stink. Billy Moore used to be able to hang his head out the window and pretty much tell you were getting close to a field. He'd sniff and say, it smells like area web blight. I think we're close.
If I need to use that diagnostic tool, can I use your truck instead of mine?
Absolutely, possibly not.
You'd lose them in the backseat of Tom's truck. Really, Tom doesn't have a backseat. He's got a storage area that's behind the driver's seat.
Tom don't have a passenger seat either.
True. All true statements. I don't have a passenger seat. There's probably two or three pairs of shoes in there right now.
And about 72 pounds of rocks.
Yeah, there are a lot of rocks in my truck. There's truth to that.
Tom, a few years ago, the frog eye was such a big deal. Have we kind of lessened that problem with genetics?
I think we've reduced that disease issue predominantly through genetics. The bulk of the entries in the statewide OVT program appear pretty resistant. But I also like to think that we just haven't ended up with the right environment in some key locations. Because, you know, we pick a fairly susceptible variety for our efficacy trial plots here in Stoneville, and we have no frog eye, none at all.
So what conditions are best for that particular pathogen?
It likes, you know, warm, humid, wet, which is kind of pretty common for this part of the country anyways. But I think you have to have things stack up exactly right. You know, the hardest thing to express as a plant pathologist is environment has so much to do with all of this that we're talking about, every bit of it. And just because, and let's take, for example, let's use something like Target Spot, because I think everybody's keyed in on that, mostly because there's no more frog eye to key in on. Target Spot's present in every single soybean field, regardless of the year. Now, whatever year it was, not that many years ago, where it rained a ton during specific growth stages and the canopy stayed wet, that disease we could see became problematic. But you've got to have that right environment for any of that to become problematic.
The old disease triangle strikes again.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we either beat that dead horse too much, or we don't talk about it enough.
On that frog eye topic, here's a way that Jason would appreciate this. Kind of like finding a cucklebur. So when you see frog eye in today's genetics, you're like, huh, there's some frog eye.
I saw a cucklebur somewhere this year. I don't remember where I was standing.
I was with you because I said, Abby dog, look at that.
I saw one yesterday in Verona, strangely enough.
Trent, you described the growth stage as kind of where the crop's at. And so what's your gut feeling on, you know, how we're going to finish out the year? And what do folks need to be thinking about next?
Well, I mean, we've already terminated irrigation on some acres, and I think that's the most immediate decision, you know, as we're in this R5.5, 6.5 kind of categories, is terminating irrigation. And, you know, as far as the crop goes, I mean, you know, we have some acres that seem to have outrun most issues, and I think we're all hoping and praying that we can continue to outrun other issues as we move forward. But we've had a really good-looking crop overall. You know, a week to 10 days ago, some of the acres that aren't irrigated kind of started going back the other way, unfortunately, not catching enough rain here in the late season. But it'll be interesting to see how it finishes out from a yield standpoint. Our acres are back up where they've been being. You know, we're right there in the 2 million acre mark. And you know, right now, I'd say yield forecasts are positive, but obviously we have a long way to go, and I don't like to really count that until we get them out of the combine.
Well, I know we're going to have some good beans. Jason and I was riding around this morning with a potential new student and drove by some of my bean plots, and I'm like, uh-oh, we got some lodging, which means we got a lot of weight out there.
There's no doubt. Tom and I were talking on the phone earlier, and we made the statement that, you know, we have some acres that are definitely yield-breaking yield potential right now, and then others that are, like I said a minute ago, going backwards.
Trent, last week, Ben texted me and said he saw some beans that had gotten desiccated somewhere he was driving. I don't remember where he said he was, but so it looks like we're, you know, at least in some fields, you know, we're beyond that growth stage you described earlier. So won't you give folks just a brief rundown on desiccating beans, and then we'll pick that up. We can do another episode on that at another time.
Yeah, there are a few acres that have been treated and others that people are considering treating. You know, some of the earliest planted stuff and really early maturity groups, trying to get them out and get an August delivery kind of thing on those acres. But, you know, generally speaking, our harvest aid applications, you know, they're more designed just to facilitate harvest and try to get a timing aspect of it or beat weather. So, you know, stay tuned for that. I think as far as the need for harvest aid goes, it'll depend on what kind of environmental situations come down the line. If it stays hot and dry, a lot of these acres will senesce, you know, naturally. But if we get into some situations with some rains and hurricanes, a couple of storms, and things of that nature, a harvest aid can be a super valuable tool.
Yeah, there's a couple of storms forming up. I looked the other day out in the Atlantic somewhere.
Yeah,
Josephine, wouldn't it?
I didn't look that deeply into it. I just saw they were, you know, they kind of had a little forecast track to them headed west, but they were still pretty far out, so I didn't delve off into it very far. Well, Trent, you got any other parting shots for the listeners?
Yeah, I guess we've talked a lot about growth stages, and these, you know, people ask at what point can I kind of quit worrying too much, and just as a general statement. I think outside of dealing with red banded sting bugs, our goal is just to get to R6.5. So just as a reminder, in the upper four nodes of the soybean plant, if we can shell open a pod and that seed will separate from the pod wall, fully separated seed in that pod, if we can get to that point, we can kind of rest a little easier and not worry so much about irrigation or plant diseases and several other things outside of red banded stink bug issues.
Tom, you got any ideas you want to share with folks before we wrap it up?
No, I completely agree with that statement. I think the bulk of the soybeans that are out there within that earliest planted window have escaped any yield loss potential as a result of foliar diseases. You know, I think folks at this point in time need to take some notes on those root issues and start thinking about doing some good field prep work and potentially rotating to different hosts depending upon which root diseases are out there and focus on those for next season.
Well, man, I hope we can get a chunk of them out and get some field work done, more so than what we've been able to do the last couple of years. I know that'll change, you know, a lot of attitudes, you know, going into the spring. A lot more optimism when we can get that field prep done later on in the fall. So, Bobby, you have anything else you want to say? All right, Bobby's done. So we appreciate Tom you walking over and sitting down with us, and Trent you pulling over on the side of the road. So I know you got places to go. So we certainly appreciate it. And guys, if we can do anything for y'all, just give us a call.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.